I want to start, if I may, then with congratulations, President Mason. I think it's appropriate for the Outcomes Committee to congratulate you for your appearance at Council with your summative report. It strikes me as quite an outcomes statement that you made, and when I read it, I can understand why the report that came to me was that very, very well received indeed. So congratulations to you and to UDC for that.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Team UDC.
Wonderful. The firebirds continue to flame, right? So yeah. This was great. So bravo. Well done. Dr. Latham has some excellent new staff that I invited him to introduce at the beginning of the meeting, but he said it was in his plans to introduce them at the beginning of his session. So we will simply say welcome now, and when we move into the meeting, we will have an introduction. So, but I will simply say welcome at this point. So let's move on to the roll call, if we may, Madam Secretary.
Dr. Berzone?
Here.
Trustee Clyburn?
Here.
Dr. Jarvis? Dr. Rudd?
Present.
Dr. Tarr?
He's here. There's.
Oh, hi, Dr. Jarvis.
Have that clicking sound? Okay,
here we go. Dr. Rudd?
Present.
Dr. Tard?
Here.
Trustee Bell? Dr. Harris?
Here.
Trustee Grossinger? Dr. Musgrove? General Schwartz? Trustee Scott? Trustee Shelton? Trustee White Richardson?
Here.
President Mason?
Here.
Chief of Staff Guillory?
Here.
Chief Student Development and Success Officer Latham?
Here.
CAO Potter? COO Franklin?
Here.
General Counsel Russell?
Here.
Madam Chair, you have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Moving on to the minutes of February 22nd, has everyone had a chance to review them? Any corrections, amendments? If not, do we have a motion for approval, please?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor, please say aye. Oh, do we have to have a vote one by one? Okay. How about I like Trustee Clyburn's approach. All in favor, please raise your hands. Well, we can't see you all. any opposed, please say nay. All right, the minutes stand approved. Thank you very much. Dr. Latham, would you like to walk us through the next steps, please, of the agenda?
Absolutely. Thank you, Trustee Garzone. So good evening, everyone. William Latham, Chief Student Development Success Officer. Really a pleasure to come back and have this conversation with the Outcomes Committee. Trustee Garzone and I have talked about this over the last few months about a reset of student outcomes post-COVID. And that's what you guys see in front of you in terms of the completion plan work, this first initial draft, right? This is our first discussion and conversation of the work group. And the plan that's been put together over the last couple of months is our initial draft. This is a living document that you'll see us continue to develop and flesh out with the work group that you see listed in the plan. So what we came up in terms of determining why we need this reset is because post-COVID we've learned a lot, obviously, right, about learning loss outside the classroom, how that's affected student outcomes, how that's addressed in some of the interventions we've already had in place, but more importantly, what interventions need to be addressed going forward. And so we wanted to put together a plan that really laid out the data in a very clean and digestible format for anyone to look at, obviously, particularly Student Outcomes Committee members, but to give the university the opportunity to weigh in terms of how the work group is a universal representation of this overall campus body and give the data to them in a way that they thought was really plausible for them to understand. And that's what you see in the completion plan that you have in front of you that was sent last week. So this reset gives us the opportunity to see what we need to do to address gaps we have around certain types of issues we have within the university, whether that be persistence, retention, graduation, or even course completion that you see outlined in the plan.
And you sat there for 2 hours watching that
We ask you to mute, of course, we appreciate it. So in the context of that, we've developed, you see the plan before you, but we've developed a shorter PowerPoint deck that we'll walk through first and then come back to the plan and look at a couple of tables within the plan itself in terms of persistence, retention, and graduate course completion numbers within the plan and ask and address any questions you guys have with the plan at that time. But we're going to kick off with a PowerPoint deck that gives a kind of a brief overview of the plan itself, and then we'll go from there into the trauma-informed care survey results. And Nyla Williams will do that presentation. Natosha Baldwin and I will present on the outcomes of the actual student outcomes committee deck that I asked Fanika to pull up now, if you don't mind, Fanika. And then we'll close out with, I want to introduce right now, as a matter of fact, Dr. Nasana Tyus. Dr. Tyus, if you could unmute for us and say hello to the committee. She's our new Vice President of Enrollment Services. We came over from Catholic University. She used to work with Trustee Drew Jarvis back in the day at Southeastern, as a matter of fact. In her younger career days, Dr. Jarvis, you mentioned that when we talked about her a couple months ago. So I'm happy to introduce her. Let her say hello quickly, then you'll hear from her at the end. It's the third part of the agenda when she discusses her work and background and a little bit of the six phases of a strategic enrollment plan that we'll discuss at that time.
Thank you so much. Introduction at this point is very brief. I wanted to say hello. Thank you so much for inviting me to today's meeting. Later in my portion of the presentation, I'll give you some more insight into my background, how I got to UDC, where I come from, and where I'm looking to go, and the planning process that we're going to use to grow enrollment here at UDC. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So again, guys, we're going to go into this deck and certainly answer any questions that the committee has as we walk through. Please stop us or raise your hand within that function, within the actual platform as well. And Latosha Ball and I would certainly address any questions that you have. And then we'll do this and then go into the trauma-informed care survey results that Nyla Williams will introduce as an AVP of Business Solutions and Operations for the SDS Division. Next slide for us, Fanika. Thank you. So we wanted to go back, obviously, as I said earlier, and do a reset post-COVID around the strategic plan goal number 2, increase the number of UDC degrees and workforce credentials awarded, but obviously create a student success model. We had this work done before COVID, obviously, in the first iteration of this EI plan. We want to come back and do a reset, as I said earlier. And so that's what this completion plan document, this first draft, represents. And so it's a continuation of a series of significant campus initiatives, as you see there, around student success interventions. And so we had success around supplemental instruction before COVID, around case management model, around even our peer advisors as another intervention. And so post-COVID, we've done some other things around redesign the student registration process post-COVID, as well as launch student navigators, which you'll see a little bit of that in the plan as well. But again, just want to give you a baseline understanding of why this work is being done and how we want it to be reinvented really post-COVID. Next slide, Fanika. I'm going to let Ms. Baldwin, she's our interim AVP of Student Success, jump in here to kick off this conversation of the student profile. As you see, not unfamiliar information that you guys already didn't know, but I think it's good to give contextualization in the plan for the overall UDC undergraduate student profile. So Ms. Baldwin's done a great job in helping put this plan together, along with Nyla Williams, myself, and the work group itself. And so I want to give an opportunity to hear her voice in this work. She's been with us for over 5 years, former director of student success within the student success cluster under Dr. Tim Hatchett, as you guys recall. Dr. Hatchett was our previous AVP of student success. And so I wanted to have her have a voice in this work and this presentation tonight to give you some context for not only who she is and what she's done, but also her insights around the work itself and her history of being here for over 5.5 years at UDC. So, Ms. Baldwin, I'm going to let you kick it off with this particular context for this deck.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having us. So just want to start off here with this undergraduate student profile. if you read the completion plan, this is all in here. We just wanted to highlight a few key points today. In the data, we show that 61% of our students are female, 52% are part-time students. The average undergraduate age of our students is 29, which has increased in the past couple of years. When you look at the completion data for our students, what you see is that 60% of our first-time, full-time, bachelor-seeking students, they are completing 80% of their credits in their first fall term. And then our first-time, full-time students for associate's degree students, they are completing 80% of their credits in their first term. And in the completion plan, we'll talk about later about why that's important. And then the last data point here, overall full-time students have higher graduation rates than part-time students. And one of the things that we thought was very interesting is that our full-time transfer, not first-time students, have the highest graduation rate. And that information, of course, is indicated in the completion plan in the charts. But we just wanted to highlight a couple of things here about who our students are here at UDC. Next slide. So as you know, in the Equity Imperative, we developed and implemented a program called Supplemental Instruction, that started a few years ago. And of course, in any initiative, you want to continue to evaluate and assess your advances and your challenges. And so here in this chart, what you see, are students who took our SI courses. Just to give you a little bit of context about supplemental instruction, this program targets high difficult courses, courses that have high D's, F's, and W rates. We look at classes that have over a 30% DFW rate that have enrolled at least 100 students. I mean, we look at that because we want to expand capacity. The students in supplemental instruction, they have what we call an SI leader. That SI leader has taken the course before, received a grade of B or higher. They come back to support students in the next semester to host collaborative learning study sessions and teach the students how to learn, and it's a peer-to-peer model. So that's what supplemental instruction is. When you look at the chart that we have before you, in the blue, these are students that just took the SI course. They took the SI course, and 82% of them persisted to the next spring. In the green, you see the students who took the SI course, but they actually attended an SI session. SI sessions are adjacent to or outside of the actual class time. And here you see that 95% of the students persisted to the next spring in fall 2020, and you see the same trend in fall 2021. So what we took from here is that students who attend SI sessions, they are more likely to persist at a higher rate. One of the challenges that we had with SI is attendance, because we have a large part-time student population. And so to increase our capacity, we are now exploring a subset of supplemental instruction called embedded tutoring. Embedded tutoring is just the tutor will actually be in the class, and they will work with the students in real time with the faculty instructor's assistants. So SI leaders do sit in the class, but they are relearning the information to host study sessions. But the embedded tutors can actually provide assistance and individualized attention while in the class. And we feel as if that will give us a bigger bang for our buck, because we have the students captured as an audience while they're currently taking the course. So that is something that we are going to explore for fall 2023. Next slide. Last summer, we worked, myself, our team, enrollment management, and all of the other SDS departments, we worked diligently to develop an orientation model for the summer to onboard our new students. What we found, just anecdotally working with students, is that our students need a lot of help. They need intrusive help, step-by-step, hand-holding assistance. So with that, and also we saw that a lot of students had learning loss when it comes to just registration, policies, and procedures. experiencing that with our students at the forefront of when we were working with them last summer, we decided to edit our advising model. So we have decided to break it up into different parts where each component of our student success advising team, they will be assigned to address and triage a student, a part of the student's onboarding process. So as you see here, you have a student success specialist and a peer advising student navigator title. When we get our accepted confirmed students, they will be assigned to onboard the student and help execute all of the administrative tasks that a student needs to complete to be a to be at UDC. Not only will they contact the students to say, hey, you need to sign up for your orientation, registration days, they will also be there to support them with the execution of the task. So instead of saying, go get this done, they will be there to say, hey, I'm here to support you. How can I can show you how to do it. What do you need from me? Next, we have our academic advisors who will be there to execute registration days with other SDS departments on, and when the students come to campus, they will be here to register, and they will also be responsible for taking a career assessment to ensure that the students are tracking properly with their declared majors. And then the last step, we have a Department of Special Programs. That team is designed to help transition the students from registration to the first 6 weeks of class. How to get your books, how to find your classes, print off your schedule, anything that is going to help a student be successful for the first day, first 6 weeks of class, that is what they are there to do. So in essence, we've designed it to where it's more structured, streamlined, and very intentional and intrusive for our students. And we want to make sure that they have a very good experience when they're onboarded to UDC. While they're here, this is a part of the retention piece. We have a case management model that we've been implementing, but some of the edits are the early alert interventions. Excuse me. About 10% of our students had a probation GPA, but we felt it best to address it through our early alerts. Let's get ahead of it. So we are looking at these different populations because we've seen some challenges with this group of students to say, hey, let's get ahead of it. And we're looking at two things. We're looking at attendance to see our students engaged in the first 3 weeks of class. And then we're also looking at their midterm grades for these different populations. Once the alerts are disseminated by inputted by faculty, the advising team, the academic coaches, and other parties involved with this program will have to contact students, reach out to students, and then, of course, provide any support that the student may need. Another piece of that is what we call our support care network. So if a student is having challenges and they share with us that they need a resource or a tool, the support care network designed through Navigate, and all of this is done in our Navigate platform, early alerts, and referral. We have a referral network within Navigate that will allow a staff member to input a referral for a student. It will go to another department, and then they will be proactive in triaging whatever that student's case is. So the bigger piece about this is, while we've heard about this before, we're editing some of the ways that we do this because we want to make sure that our students get the best experience, have all the tools and resources they need in a timely manner. Next slide. As you saw in the data, the transfer students that we have, they have a higher graduation rate, but we did conduct a focus group a couple of semesters ago where they shared that one of the things that they need is their own orientation, and they would like to do things that will make them feel connected to the university. Great feedback. So we have designed a Student Transfer Resource Center. It will be a website where it details all of the information that transfer students need to know. The admissions process, the evaluation process, all of that is complete and in draft form on the website. We are going to host our own transfer student orientation this summer, 2023. We have a staff member that is dedicated specifically for transfer students to develop programming for them as they become integrated into the UDC Firebird Nation. So that's to be launched fall 2023. We are looking at an honor society around spring 2024, and then, of course, a transfer student association, a club organization, again, to foster a sense of belonging for our transfer students. Next slide. Excuse me. Another initiative that we have going on, of course, we'll have career services forever, but it's the how that shifts when it comes to retention work. We are, again, looking at a redesign. And what does that redesign mean? So in some of the data, it shared that we have to do something different. And, of course, one of the things that is important are career competencies for our students. Are they ready for the workforce? What does our product look like when they get out of UDC and they go to work? So we are looking at developing an experiential learning badging program. What will this do? This will allow us to keep track of our students' career readiness competencies to help make them more marketable before and after graduation. We have a platform called Presence in SDS that can help us build this out. We also want to look at providing our students with micro internships. These are like small projects where students can work with an employer, do a small project, maybe a few hours or a few weeks, and earn some credit as far as workforce credit. We have been working on infusing the career readiness competencies into all the relevant departments in academic affairs. Why? Because there are 8 career readiness competencies that are explained in the completion plan document, and actually they are universal. So every department can look at their learning outcomes and what their mission is and see that these 8 competencies could potentially live within their area. So we're going to be intentional about highlighting that when we build out this badging program. And then, of course, again, establishing or declaring a major is very key to our students' persistence and success. So all FTICs will be required to take the career assessment. Right now we have the Focus 2 assessment during their orientation sessions. And this information will allow us to have conversations with students at the front end if their major and their assessment do not align, because we want to make sure that the students track well to be successful to graduation. Next slide. And as we mentioned before, and I know you guys have seen this data, this information, we have several technology platforms in our area. And honestly, these platforms allow for the, it saves time on the work. It makes things more efficient. It has increased our ability to engage with our students. And so we do have our Assistant Vice President of Operations and Business Solutions, Naila Williams, who is going to be instrumental in building the workout for more to come when it comes to our platforms. But this is just an overview of what we have. Excuse me. Navigate, which includes the Academic Planner. And for those of you that are not familiar, the Academic Planner allows advisors to go in and digitally advise a student. The student will receive an email with their course recommendations. And we also have launched the one-button registration feature in Navigate as of spring 2023. We went through testing, and so now we're going to roll it out for this summer and fall registration to make sure that students understand how to use it and, again, make registration more efficient for them. Of course, we've had the mobile app. We launched it 2 summers ago, and we are continuing to build our usage of the mobile app and Navigate. Presence, as I mentioned, is our student life and badging program. We have Handshake, which is our internship job platform and career services. We have DegreeWorks, which is our degree audit software that is housed in the Office of the Registrar. And then, of course, we are currently in the CRM discovery phase, which, as you know, this particular software will allow us to streamline our admissions processes and, of course, increase communication with our prospective to registered students at UDC. That concludes my portion of the presentation. Do we have any questions?
Just so the committee can see, obviously, next steps right there for the completion plan. as you see, right, we're going to obviously look at the committee's membership and expand it across the colleges, at the university, and academic affairs. Dr. Potter's partner, obviously, with us, and Dr. Krasick in this particular work. And then, obviously, we're going to have sub-work groups and focus on some of the trauma work that you see. You hear from that trauma survey from Nyla Williams here shortly. But work groups that will be formed to specifically address what we see in terms of data coming from that particular survey with the director of the Counseling Center, director of Health Services, director of our Disability Resource Center, Dr. Beckett, leading that charge, as well as the AVP student development here. And then we'll talk about what we're going to do with the strengths-based culture, right? We're going to relaunch our strengths, Gallup Strengths Initiative in the fall. We launched that work that we started in 17 and 19 here. It really had us really structured and going towards becoming a strengths-based campus. We're going to relaunch that in the fall. Very excited to see that work come through student orientation processes in terms of the strengths finding being assessed by our students and taken by our students. And using that work and that assessment to help our advisors, help our career counselors, guide them through this first year experience, even second year experience for our students. So those are kind of the next steps of the completion plan. I want to give you guys an overview of. And happy again, have any questions on the completion plan before we jump into the trauma and care survey results?
I do. I have a few questions. Thank you. This is Dr. Harris, Preston Harris. My first question is in relation to the SI component. I recognize that there's a lot of things being done to support students, and I love the peer-to-peer interactions. Can you tell me, have you theorized a web-based component? Because a lot of our students may not be able to get back to campus for those SI tutorials, and whether or not there could also be an online chat for students to dump their questions during those virtual or web-based SI sessions.
Thank you. Great question. So, yes, when COVID hit, we converted to online, and when we shifted back to our being on campus, we kept a virtual component so that we could increase our capacity for servicing students. So the biggest challenge with SI is because it is a set day and time, you know, like I said, we do have a large part-time student population, a large adult population, so it's just trying to get them to find the opportunities to fit those days and time. And because it is a peer support program, they're also taking classes and working. So what we've been doing is just trying to figure out what is the best way. And that's when we came up with the idea of the embedded tutors, because we have a captured audience. But of course, we are open to other opportunities. We are looking at some other tutoring components that can supplement what we already do that will support online and evening weekend hours. We are looking into that currently.
The other question I have is regarding enrollment, and I should have asked it a little earlier, but what are we doing to capture those students who are already within UDC to make it more fluid for them to cross from campus to campus? When I came on the board last summer, I spoke about having some type of early admission or vetting to let students know who are here that they are a desire to go from Backus campus to the Van Ness campus, from the Van Ness campus over to the David A. Clark campus. And so what are we doing to make students know that they don't even need to go looking for a graduate program at Howard or somewhere else, that they're wanted here?
I can speak for the undergraduate component. My area, student success advising and admissions, and the community college leaders, Dean Hamilton and Dr. Hacker, have been having conversations about, we call it a transition day, but what that would look like is basically like an open house, you know, Van Ness coming down to the CC to talk about liberal study, talk about our degrees and inform the students of what's happening. And then, of course, we have communications that will help them transition from the CC to the main campus if necessary. Regarding the graduate level or bachelor's to law school or graduate level, I would have to defer to Malva Reed with that, but definitely something, an opportunity that we could look into.
And I don't know if that person is on the call and who can chime in at this time, but I do have another question if that person is not on the call at this time.
Dr. Malva Reed, I don't think she's here today.
Yeah, she's not. So we continue to partner with Dr. Reed in terms of the CEO's office Trustee Harris. So that's an ongoing relationship there. So with that relationship will continue to develop as we get more strategic about how we do the Common App for grad, as well as the undergrad Common App that's in process now to be launched. So those two processes are going to link us and continue to link us to the CAO's graduate student work and graduate recruitment work. So that process will continue to get better and more streamlined as we go forward. We did do, going back to the transition question, we did do some transition days and sessions last spring at the CC, right, to allow students to understand that work specifically in the transition process to Van Ness campus. So those will continue again this spring. That's working with Dr. Hacker and Dean Hamilton again at the community college. So that's obviously a close relationship we have with them that continues to get stronger. So those will continue this spring as well, because that is pivotal for us to make sure that we have that transition process laid out with the academic advisors there, and that that's more seamless, right, because the pathway has been developed academically. Now we need to sell that to the student, right, around what that process looks like and have support for them in that transition. So that's what we're doing now with academic affairs at the community college specifically.
Okay. I will just state, at some point I would love to hear how we're then moving the students we have from the Van Ness campus to David A. Clark and what we're doing to be supportive there. My last question was that oftentimes when we talk about student outcomes, we spend a lot of time speaking about students who require handholding or additional supports because they lack either the academic skill set or the academic maturity to matriculate in the way in which perhaps we would expect. I'd like to hear about what specifically are we doing to fast forward matriculation or counseling opportunities for students who don't need that handholding, who came to UDC ready to run so that they understand how to advance their curriculum, or how we can then fast track for students who are a little behind so that they get back on board. Thank you.
Thank you, Trustee. Duly noted. Trustee Jarvis?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Latham. I guess I'm trying to figure out to whom, at what level, the SI program is available, or is it to students at any level, or is it particularly orientation and support for new students coming in? And I'm just trying to get an idea of how many students are actually in the SI program compared to the number of students who, I guess, for each level, are not in the program and don't need it. I'm just trying to get a sense of those proportions.
Got it. Ms. Baldwin, you want to give her that background context there?
Sure. In the implementation of SI, we started out with majority of the courses were high math, science, and writing courses. With a few outliers like accounting, and we were focusing on one section of the course. So a section here at UDC will run you about 20 to 25 students, and I would have to pull the raw data for you to get you the actual numbers, but our attendance ratio for students in the class that were attending was roughly, I'll have to get the raw data because I want to speak accurately about the numbers, but when we ran the data again for this past year and this year, the same classes came out at Van Ness because I oversee the Van Ness program, Dr. Jarvis, and it was still in the IJED courses, your math courses, and your biology and chemistry classes. So that's for incoming freshmen. When I look at the raw data, I'll have to get that to you, but that's why we had to pivot, because the numbers of attendance were lower. Of our students attending SI.
So the majority, it seems that the majority are in the incoming class.
Dr. Carlos, oh, sorry, excuse me, you go ahead. I want to tail on to your question, but you're not finished, please. Yeah.
May I just finish the question? The metrics.
Is that someone muted who's not speaking?
I'm sorry, am I coming in and out? Am I not heard? Is that what you're saying?
You're fine.
Dr. Jarvis, we hear you.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Jarvis, we can hear you.
Okay. Yes. So, and the metrics are the metric is principally persistence. Is that it? Is that essentially what you're they want to know if students are persisting, semester to semester. What are you finding? Or did I just miss that you said that? I didn't see the metric.
No, we showed it, the chart that's in the completion plan, or the the PowerPoint shows that students that took an SI core, that course that actually attended a course SI session, they persisted at a higher rate than those.
I did see all of that.
Okay, yes.
I did. Thank you very much. It is somebody who's been on the board for a long time. It takes a long time to develop these successful programs and measurements. And I'm impressed that, you know, it just takes dogged perseverance to do it. But you've been able to do what you said you were going to do, which is to figure out how to give these students the kind of support that they need in order to succeed. And I'm impressed by the various ways in which you have figured out how to support students, including embedding the tutors in the course. And if that's what it takes, that's what it takes to get them to persist and graduate. So, you know, it's I'm impressed by what you're doing.
Thank you,
Mr. President.
Dr. Jarvis, thank you for the
thank
question.
You.
And this is a good example of what Dr. Latham was pointing to before when he said he and I had agreed that there was a need to reset in this committee, because I think there are some things that are still unclear to me, and I think unclear to a lot of us, even those of us who've been in higher ed for a while. And one is just this program, exactly. It's unclear what SI, to me, what SI is attached to. Is it attached to gateway courses that are gateway because they're general education, or are they gateway because they're courses where students stumble and fall and it causes problems as they try to advance in their academic careers, you know, like the famous physical chemistry, PCHEM, if they're trying to do science courses. What is it that leads you to choose a course to be an SI course? Is it a course that is a course that is a remediation course? What are the courses that come to be given this very successful SI program? And maybe it's all three. How do you decide what course attracts an SI designation? And so I think that's another way to ask this question.
Great question, Dr. Barazzoni. So when we pull the grade data for all of the courses offered at UDC Venice, I'll just say Venice because that's where my program is, we look at all the D's, F's and W's, and then I get a sum of 30% or higher. So if we have a sum of 30% or higher, I look at those, and then the next step is how many students actually took said course. So for example, if you have two students that take aviation maintenance 222 and one withdraws, then they have a 50% withdrawal rate, but it's only servicing two students. So we've added an extra layer of a 30% sum of D's, F's, and W's that students have earned in this course, and at least 100 students have taken this course. And we did it that way to expand capacity because we wanted to make sure we had a further reach for our students. You could do it, but we only have 10 SI leaders that are in this program. So when we did it that way, we found that it was living in a few IGEDs, math, and science courses with a few other outliers. So that's what's been coming up on the report. And in the completion plan, I have a list of classes that you can see that we're going to look at for fall 2023. And we try to reset every couple of years. I look at the data every year to see kind of like what the DFW rates are. But one of the things that's important is that we see progress with the initiatives that we're doing. We want to make sure that they're effective. So, and then again, that's another reason why we look to a supplemental tutoring program outside of that to help support other subjects that we don't have in the SI program.
So on student performance, it's not on these are the remediation courses or it's the gateway courses, as it turns out. Not gateway, but it's courses that are known student failure or withdrawal courses.
Correct. So one of the courses is calculus. So calculus, not necessarily a gateway course for some majors, it is for engineering. So Math 105 is actually the gateway course at the Van Ness campus. We did implement supplemental instruction at the community college, and we would have to defer to Dean Hacker for that. But I'm trying to remember if remedial courses came up on that on theirs. But for sure here at Van Ness, we have entry-level English 1, 2, and 3. We have the math courses for sure, and then we have biology and chemistry, where students just need a lot of support in general.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else?
See Bill.
Hi there. Hello, everyone. I'm sorry that I'm late, and I apologize if you covered this in your presentation earlier, but I'm curious if this program teases out students that have special needs that are unable to access the curriculum because they have an IEP or other learning challenges, that are neurodiverse learners, and if we're able to offer supports to them through this program, or if there is something else that's in place to help those type of learners access the curriculum so that they can also achieve success at the university.
Great question. So at this time, students are not allowed to receive any information regarding ADA accommodations for students because SI is a peer-to-peer model. SI in its true form is collaborative learning techniques. So the SI leaders are not instructing the students. For example, if there's a math problem, the SI leader is not going to say, what's the problem? Here's the answer. They're going to encourage peer-to-peer learning. How do you read your notes? They're going to design a lesson plan on how to, or like games and quizzes for the students so that they can learn how to study. Excuse me. There's like at least 30 techniques that they can do in these sessions that are, they're fun, they're innovative, they're creative, and they really allow the student to be independent, self-learn, but also pull on their colleagues. And if an SI leader doesn't know something, their job is to go back to the instructor, get some strategies that will help the students in the sessions, but they're not to learn. Embedded tutors, however, are content experts in the subject and would be there to assist the student. If there's accommodation that needs to be made for the student regarding learning, that's a good point. I would have to look at that to see what we could do because of confidentiality. But I'm quite sure there's some research out there that can assist us. And we have support from the SI, University of Missouri, Kansas. We can reach to that team, too, to ask them for support for that. But that's a good point. I'm going to write that down.
And I'm curious, thank you for that explanation, Ms. Baldwin. I'm curious also, do we know what the size of our population is of students that are classified as special learners that have IEPs or that from high school or that would benefit from this type of instruction? Because that population is different from those that need remedial education, per se, or can be.
Okay. So,
Trustee Bell, we can get that specific data. We obviously have the Office of Disability Resource Center here that certainly triages and accommodates all accommodations, as you know, for our students. And that certainly that office has increased in its particular client and case management load over the last couple of years. So we do see an uptick in the students who are requesting accommodations across the board. I can get to those numbers. I can send you those numbers regarding what those actual data points are for the number of students within the ARC portfolio of this semester. We don't have those in front of me now. We can get those to you. Certainly, but we know it's been an uptick because of that. And we actually think that's good for us because that gives us an opportunity to really understand what the need is before it becomes problematic. We want more students to give us that opportunity to have that conversation in the front end because certainly after mid-semester or to come in after the semester starts and say, I need an accommodation. It's very tough for them to get, you know, through a process and get the professor on board and have to go through a redesign of that accommodation process midterm or mid-semester. So we think it's good for us to kind of make sure we market and advertise our ARC office that way and make sure that people are aware, but we can get those numbers and actually get those.
Trustee Musgrove, I just have one question. And looking at the plan, I think you've done a great job. But I do have a question about monitoring. How will the programs be monitored? Are you going to have a close monitoring system set up so that students don't get lost and so that staff is kept abreast of everything that they're supposed to be doing?
Absolutely. Navigate is a wonderful platform that I'm so grateful that Dr. Latham purchased this. It is instrumental in how we track our students regarding the data. So we have a feature in Navigate that allows us to tag different cohorts of students. There's an intervention effectiveness tool that we use in there. So when it comes to monitoring students' progress, we're able to keep up with who is a part of which cohort, who's a part of which initiative, and then we can pull that data down every year to see what type of progress is being made depending on the initiative. Because, as I mentioned, we want to make sure that the work that we're doing is being impactful and that we're seeing an uptick in retention, graduation, persistence, so on and so forth.
And as we take on new staff and all, do we have constant or continuing professional development to make sure that staff is kept up to date with what the staff should be doing?
So in my area of student success, we have ongoing trainings. We have meetings every Wednesday, and then we have cluster meetings where we are from the top down talking about what the work needs to look like, or what and the how. So, yes, we have ongoing professional development for them regarding.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Trustee Shelton, I think you wanted to speak.
No, thank you. I took my hand down.
Oh, okay. Anything else?
Any other questions from anyone? Now we're going to proceed to the next section of the deck, which is the trauma-informed care survey results. And this is going to be presented by Ms. Naila Williams, our Assistant Vice President of Business Operations and Solutions.
Okay.
They just pull that deck up now. So I'm going to turn it over to Naila. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you, Dr. Latham, and thank you, Franika. Good evening again, everyone. My name is Naila Williams, and I am the Assistant Vice President for Operations and Business Solutions for SDS. And today I'm just going to give you all some information regarding the assessment that we administer to students in January. The Division of Student Development and Success developed a conceptual framework that was focused on three core areas, which were experiences, events, effects, and the resulting responses from students. The assessment was sent to all students at the end of January. The self-assessment was administered and intended to do so to assist students in reflecting on life experiences, events, stressors, coping strategies, potential impacts and the potential impacts on their performance. The assessment check the pulse of how students are currently faring socially, environmentally, psychologically, physiologically, college experiences, health, traumatic experiences, and coping strategies are being utilized. The assessment contained 24 questions, and we had a total of 403 respondents. Additionally, this assessment was anonymous to students. It was anonymous for students to submit. We embedded resources such as counseling center resources, accessibility services, and recommended coping strategies. And the next slide, Franika, please. On this slide is just a quick snapshot of our respondents. So we were very surprised to see 40% were Gen Zers. We often see challenges in just catching their attention and getting them to engage in surveys. And this survey was administered without any incentive. We did push it out quite a few times. We were very happy to see that this particular group responded, and this topic really resonated with our Gen Zers. 71% attend the Van Ness campus that responded. 76% identified as female. 48% indicated they were taking in-person classes. 66% are enrolled full-time, and 44% identified as first generation. And unfortunately, a whopping 44% has indicated they have a mental health diagnosis and/or concerns. Next slide, please. It was important for us to identify some life stressors and events, current and past, that might impact a student's overall wellness. We know that nationally, 60% of men, 50% of women, and 66% of college students have reported at least one exposure to one or more traumatic events. We have completed an extensive mining of this assessment data. The survey has allowed us to really better understand the students' needs, identify additional supports that we need to provide here at the university, and expand training of staff. Of the 46 life stressors and events that were listed in the survey assessment, we have noted the top six. So the top six in this order, change in sleeping habits, that was students rated at a 64%, feeling anxious, 60%, stressed and overwhelmed and nervous, 57%, poor concentration, lack of focus, 52%, financial concerns, change of finances, 50%, death of a family member or close friend, 26%. Next slide, please. During the fall board retreat, Dr. Latham introduced that the SDS division will be embarking on the trauma-informed care approach. And this is just a reminder of that approach that was introduced and where we are currently as a division. So we are at the first two stages, which are realizing, of course, the prevalence of the impact of the pandemic has had on students. And now we're in the process of being trained on how to recognize those symptoms in students, trauma in students. Our next steps are, of course, to learn how to appropriately respond and resist re-traumatizing students as we engage them, especially as more students begin to return to campus in person. So that's where we are currently as far as the trauma-informed care approach and where we're headed. The next slide, please. From the data, from the assessment, we have determined that it is pivotal to build a holistic mental health network. The holistic network focuses on the well-being and resilience of each student and is built upon a foundation of self-care. This network begins with self-care at the bottom, as you can see on the slide here, and builds towards crisis care at the top, with steps in between to help students. We have formed a work group that will be kicking off shortly to help build this particular network out. And our work group is going to be a cross-functional team of various members inside of SDS and outside of SDS. And what we're going to do is make this an interactive, integrated resource for students where they can quickly access any resources they may need, whether it's they will hover over, for example, seeking help. So if someone is experiencing suicidal ideation, they will know who to immediately call. If they want to get some tips on practicing self-care, we'll have some tips there, such as exercising daily, eating a balanced meal, connecting with the food pantry, et cetera. So it's going to be very interactive, and we plan to do this digitally as well as a hard copy for students to have on hand. Next slide, please. We want to also recognize one of our newest departments here in SDS, which is the Office of Student Advocacy and Support. It's currently being headed by Kathy Donahue, who's been doing some fantastic work so far with students. And the Office of Student Advocacy and Support was launched this past November, and it provides one-on-one assistance, coordinates services across campus and facilities, partnering with community-based resources. The mission, of course, is to help students who are experiencing temporary crisis and guide those students through their current, whatever their life stressors they may be currently experiencing, and anything that the student is encountering that may be create a barrier in them impeding their academic progress. So again, Ms. Donahue's been doing some great work thus far, and we look forward to continue partnering with her and getting the word out about this unique opportunity that students have here to engage in an office that will help them advocate for their needs. Next slide, please. So we did want to share out some of the current resources we have for students here at the university. And we just spoke about the student advocacy and support. We also have a crisis line that is available to students 24/7. And we've also had SEDEMA for a number of years for special population groups that may need additional support, such as undocumented students, international students, et cetera. So we do have quite a few of current resources in-house. We wanted to make sure that we are better marketing these resources and really consolidating resources so students are aware of all the vast majority of resources we have currently here at the university. Some next steps we're going to also do here, of course, is additional training with staff. We are going to wrap up our final trauma-informed care session in partnership with the College of Arts and Sciences in April. We're going to also do a poverty simulation early summer, and we hear that it's going to be a very life-changing experience for all that partake. It's going to be a half-day workshop where we can actually walk in the shoes of students who are experiencing poverty, which is about half of our student population. So we are looking forward to that simulation, and we'll share more about that in future board meetings there. And then we're going to expand our services as well, resources as well. We want to create safe spaces where they're visibly identifiable for students, where if they're experiencing a trauma, they know that when they enter a person's office, that is a safe space. We want to build out or relaunch our financial literacy program. That still remains one of the stressors since the onset of the pandemic, and it currently remains one of the top stressors. So we want to make sure that students are aware of all available financial resources, whether that's internal or external, here in the district, and really you can just consolidate those resources so we can take some of the stress and pressure off of students. While we may be able to necessarily increase the amount of funding we're giving them, we can just better help them to better manage that funding and explore other resources that can help alleviate some of that stress. That includes what we want to share out here, and I'll just pause there to see if there are any questions or comments before I turn it back over to Dr. Latham.
Could I just ask a question? You had about, am I right, you had about 260 responses on this questionnaire. Is that right?
So we had a total of 403 respond. It had been scrubbed some because some students did not answer all questions. With multi-part questions, they didn't fully answer all parts of the questions. So other students who answered all questions, that's what's reflected on the package that was provided to the board.
I see. Okay, thank you. I was just trying to see because it looked to me as if fewer than 1% of the students responded. So. Okay, thank you. Dr. Jarvis. Dr. Jarvis, please.
I had to unmute. I'm sorry. I'm just wondering how many staff you have in that office. That seems an enormous load. How many staff members are in that particular part of your staff?
On the Office of Student Advocacy?
Yeah.
So we have just initially the director, because we just started the office 2-3 months ago. We're going to put two additional staff in that office. The plan is to have them in place by the fall, trustee.
I see.
And so, but we do actually going to start using student interns and externs in that office as well. So that's going to be very helpful to her, as well as additional FTEs coming to the shop within the fall semester.
Yeah, that is great. It's very needed. It's very innovative. Thanks.
My question is about the interface with the district government. Has there been a strong interface with the district government? When I was faced with the challenge of needs, finding the area that's responsible for the majority of my children enabled us to make sure that they got their benefits and that we were aware that there are benefits that were available to them. Is the person in that office making physical contact with the different departments that liaison with the majority of our students, because most of them live in geographical areas, and you have to attack each geographical area. That's one. And with our gifted and talented students who have an assessment or a plan of academics, does that not transition from the high school to our records, or does the student responsible for bringing those kinds of records to the program?
So to the first part of your question, Trustee Shelton, we have done a lot of legwork to collect the resources that the district has, so we brought that together. We are trying to continue to work with the district to get direct points of contacts for referrals. So Ms. Donahue is continuously trying to do that, that piece, so that, again, we don't have to re-traumatize students or further frustrate students when they're trying to seek services. So that is continuing to be a work in progress. As far as getting the direct point of contact for service, external services. And the second part of your question, you were asking about, were you asking about IEPs or?
Yes, IEPs transitioning with the student from high school in their records.
So unfortunately, they're not allowed to share those records with us because of HIPAA, so students are expected to self-disclose. And we cover that a couple of different times. We covered, of course, during orientation, some pre-admissions materials, and as well as transition day, just reinforcing the importance of students self-identifying and going through the necessary steps to receive an official accommodation. We certainly wish that we could have a record sharing agreement. That would make things a lot easier, but right now it's on the student to self-disclose and to procure those services.
Is that the law, or is that a practice of the district public schools and the university?
I don't believe it's the law. I know Maria Bird has been working for quite some time. I don't think we've had any progress on a data sharing agreement, but we, from what we were told, that they were pushing back heavily on that particular piece, is sharing that information. So it's not a law per se, but we may need some help in just highlighting the importance of that information being shared, so we can better support students before they even arrive at the university.
But that is.
That allows us to jump in and note that you're exactly correct. We've been working with OSSE on that. And we are actually working with the Data Vault, which is the district's data sharing agreement with all the various agencies. And Dr. Latham is aware that as soon as that becomes live and is operational, UDC will have access, and specifically his advocacy director will have access to that system, which will give access to the various agencies across the district that provide social services. And we are very hopeful that potentially maybe IEP and other type of student records will be able to come over. But that is being worked on, and OSSE is leading that initiative.
But we do know that the practice of a number of public school systems and private school systems has been to identify early special needs children and labeling them and locking them in and then underfunding their support. And are we taking that into consideration? Because if kids don't come with all of the support they're supposed to receive, and then when they get here, they're ashamed of it, and it should be incumbent on all of us to push them to use that American Express card, because we have a responsibility that goes hand in hand with the high schools or the public schools or the private schools they come from. But most of our kids have been targeted and labeled, whether real or imaginary.
And Trustee, let me jump in and say that, you know, RSA, one of the disability agencies within the district, is a partner of ours, that we make sure that we have that list of students that comes over every year that you're probably familiar with through Dr. Beckett, and she's our liaison to that particular agency. So what we're trying to do is use RSA as a model for what we can do through OSSE and Data Vault agreement that Maria Bird just spoke on, to help us get to that point of getting access to the IEPs. Believe me, we know that we have to get access to that.
But there's funding that travels with those students into college.
It does for RSA, for sure. We get that, right? And we help them use that for books, Barlett, and other resources as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
This is Trustee White Richardson. Dr. Latham, let me ask a question. I'm trying to follow all these little special groups that we're identifying. If I'm not mistaken, the office that you're talking about, because you said it just got developed, but you said 2 months ago?
Mm-hmm.
Server, okay. So what Ms. Brown and Ms. Williams do, that comes under that office? What they're talking about? I mean, the department that you just talked about, those two services they provide will come under that department?
No, that would be coming under our Accessibility Resource Center, those two areas, right, in terms of the IEP and the RSA program. So that's another unit within the Student Development Cluster called our Accessibility Resource Center. So the Office of Student Advocacy would support that unit.
Okay, the Office of Student Advocacy would support the group you're talking about with the learning aspect.
Yes.
But I'm talking about the two programs that we're spoken about tonight, the one with trauma and the one with reaching out to students who are withdrawing or D's or F, that kind of thing. Are they under the same umbrella?
Same for not same division, but not the same cluster. They're two separate clusters that they'd be under.
Okay. And what are the two clusters? Give them to me again. I'm trying to see this tree.
Connection, so is student success, which is where the SI program lies, supplemental instruction, and then student development, which is where ARC lies, Accessibility Resource Centers.
Okay.
And also where health services lies.
Let me question. Because the two things you're talking about, do they ever get together? Do they ever communicate? Because a person could be having problems in success, but it could be related to the fact they got trauma. Or not having success can cause the trauma.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Are points where they come together.
They do. That's the referral network that Ms. Baldwin spoke about earlier.
Okay.
To navigate the platform that's connecting all those offices within the EAB software platform. And so on top of that, there's a work group that we put together to address those as well. So they will have monthly meetings around the trauma-informed survey to further collaborate and use the referral network more systematically. But those are the two ways in which those offices are connected to the other offices within SDS and even across campus to other offices outside of SDS.
Okay, and the IEP piece, the learning, the ABA, that piece, that is another, that's a third leg? Isn't that a third leg?
It's a part of what you would see through the ARC, right? Okay. That's why we have to get the data sharing agreement set up with the OSCE so we can get access to it. But that also would come under ARC, the Accessibility Resource Center, which is in the Student Development Cluster. But again, it's a part of the network, referral network, and a part of the work group that's been put together as well.
Well, let me ask you a question, and then I'm going to be through. If a child who has an IEP was applying to some other institution than the University of the District of Columbia, would that institution have access to that information?
It depends. Right? That depends. It's no universal yes or no. It depends on the institution and what they're asking of OSCE to deliver to them. We're asking OSCE to deliver that to us now, right? Which is why we're pursuing the IEP conversation through the data sharing and data vault agreement that Ms. Burry spoke about. We know it's necessary for our students to be successful. We must have the information to be able to help triage them accordingly. It's imperative for us to get that in place to do so. That's why we would ask for that. But I couldn't speak to every other institution asking for that. Some do, some don't. So it would depend on the institution.
But do you understand why I'm asking that question? Let me tell you why I'm asking the question. If I'm a private institution, could OSCE give me that as opposed to being a public institution, i.e. tied together through the government? That's all I'm asking. Because somebody asked about the legality of it.
I don't know if Maria, has it come up in your conversation with OSCE? I'm not sure directly. The public-private matter.
No, it has not. But what I know is that typically what OSCE has was before, and I know Nyla, even for some other information that they share with us, we had to put a disclosure on the admissions application. Typically, the students would have to authorize for information to come from OSCE or the school to the institution the college are trying to attend. And so we could double check on that, but my understanding is that the student would have to authorize, just like they do for us, authorize the release of their records.
That's what I needed to hear, Ms. Bird. Okay. I got
Any other questions? at all trustees? If not, we can move on to Dr. Tyus and her presentation. All right, Dr. Tyus, you're up.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Franika. Good evening, everyone. I am Dr. Hassana Tyus, the new Vice President for Enrollment Services here at UDC. I am officially almost 3 weeks into the job as of Wednesday. So thank you all for your vote of confidence. I'm very excited to begin the work. I've hit the ground running in the past 3 weeks. I'm currently doing a listening session, scheduling meetings with people around campus to learn more and gain situational awareness about what is going on across the institution. So today I'm going to give you a brief introduction about me, who I am, where I come from, why UDC, my years of experience, what brought me here. Then we'll jump into trends in higher education and what that means for UDC, paying close attention. So we're going to look across all sectors, but paying close attention to the sectors that we serve. So public, two-year, four-year, graduate, and adult learner communities. And then last, it's going to be a very high overview of strategic enrollment planning and what that will look like. As we move forward in the planning process, of course, you will get very detailed information about what the planning process will look like as we develop a steering committee and working groups and lay out our communications plan. You will be well informed of what we're doing along the way. But today's presentation about strategic enrollment management will be very high level, but please feel free to ask me any questions at all about my vision for planning and the direction that we'll go with planning. Next slide, please. Thank you. Some of you might have seen this presentation before. I did present this presentation during my very long interview process, so you might have heard this before. But my educational journey, I've been in higher education. I come from public education. Growing up in Pennsylvania, went to public high school, public university, so I know how important public education is in terms of affordability and accessibility. I fell in love with higher ed after I moved here to DC to go to graduate school, and I've been in higher education ever since. I've worked at universities throughout the district, public four-year HBCUs and PWIs, small, large, faith-based, and a small graduate school in here in DC. So I'm very familiar with the city, very committed to serving the students of the district. And I've worked in various capacities across enrollment management. So I've worked in the registrar area. I've worked and or managed admissions, financial aid, recruitment, registrar, student accounts, bursar. But my background is also in institutional research. So I'm very data focused. And because I've worked in these areas, I'm familiar with the methodology and technological platforms needed to manage an enrollment management. But throughout my career, I've restructured and reorganized enrollment offices that led to increased operational efficiency and service delivery. And I've been involved in institutional and enrollment planning over the past 11 years. I also do a lot of assessment work and accreditation work. I will say in my last role as the Associate Vice President of Enrollment Management and Interim VP of Enrollment Management at Catholic, my team and I were successfully able to grow enrollment by leveraging our financial aid models to create and develop and shape the most diverse incoming freshman class that Catholic University has ever had. So that was fall 2022. So I'm very happy to bring that with me and that energy to UDC. So when I seen the opportunity, this opportunity present itself, the culmination of the things that I've done, knowing the students that I want to serve, I was like, how do I sign up for this opportunity? So I'm very happy to be here and jump into the work that is required. I know it's a big job, but I am confident that we will be successful. Next slide, please. So for the sake of time, this presentation could easily be an hour. So I'm going to kind of speed this up a bit and draw your attention to certain data points in these slides. But as you know, undergraduate and graduate enrollment have been on the decline over the past 10 years. So well before coronavirus, enrollment was on the decline for various reasons. Lack of trust in higher education, changing higher ed landscape. You know, students now, kids come out of high school and they want to be TikTok stars. So it's, you know, it's a very different landscape. So enrollment has declined over the past 10 years. But for this presentation, I want to look at fall 2020 to fall 2022. And in fall 2022, there was a 1.1% decline across all sectors of higher education. So your community colleges, your public 4 years, 2 years, private and for-profit at both the undergraduate and graduate level. So if you look at the middle of the screen under the fall 22, all those bold numbers with negatives in front of them, you could see that there were declines at both undergraduate, grad, and across the public sectors as well at the undergraduate and graduate level. So just to give you an idea, to show you year over year, enrollment is declining everywhere. Next slide, please. But with that said, even though enrollment is declining, there has been growth at HBCUs at the undergraduate level. So in 2022, HBCUs saw a 2.5% increase. That was largely due to freshman enrollment. So students coming straight out of high school are realizing that HBCUs are where it's at. So I'm not sure if it's the George Floyd effect, if it's the racialized incidents going on across the country, if students are just realizing that HBCUs provide a different kind of nurturing environment that would help them thrive, but freshman students are noticing and choosing HBCUs. So this presents an interesting opportunity for us here at UDC, but also undergraduate enrollment at predominantly or primarily online institutions grew by 3.2% last year, but 23.4% increase since fall 2020. So that's significant with these students coming straight out of high school, 18 to 20. They're not going to your traditional brick and mortar. They're looking at online institutions, primarily online institutions. So that's also something for us to take a look at. And overall, graduate enrollment at these predominantly online institutions continues to decline, but there are increases for students in their 20s. So what does that mean for UDC? It's a unique opportunity for us to stress the historical significance of HBCUs and the value proposition of what we bring. So as we develop our marketing strategy, as we get into this planning phase to really communicate and partner with our marketing team, the marketing team and I will be functioning in lockstep very closely to create messaging that highlights why we're significant and why it's valuable to come to us. There are two HBCUs in the District of Columbia, not just one. So we want to make people aware of that and know how valuable we are in our position in the district. But also, this is an opportunity for us to look at expanding our online and hybrid program offerings. We do have some already, but throughout this planning process, we'll have a chance to look at how we can expand our offerings because there's a demand here. Next slide, please. Community colleges and adult learners, which are populations that we serve. While there are declines at the community colleges across the board, the decline has slowed, but I will say that at UDC Community College, there was a 17% year-over-year enrollment increase. So when I looked at the enrollment numbers prior to joining the team, I was like, well, what is the community college doing? What are they doing to create this 17% enrollment increase? So I had a chance today to go and meet with that team to talk about, okay, what's working, what's not working, you know, what are we doing? So we'll have a chance to examine that and incorporate those wins and successes and strategies into our enrollment plan as well. The data suggests that this increase is due to high school students taking dual enrollment classes at community college, and that's an area for us to explore. We do have dual enrollment partnerships, but how can we expand those? How can we attract those students and get them to understand the value of dual enrollment and how taking a class in high school, you can have that credit if you come to UDC. Community colleges nationally continue to see declines, but there's opportunities there for students 25 to 29. We have to focus our attention to certain age groups and these particular sectors. But what we have found amongst those students, there is, if you look in the middle under fall 2022, there's these blue areas. The rest of them are orange. Under fall 2022, there's a need for upskilling and reskilling of adults. People are looking to get an undergraduate certificate. Enrollment in those programs went up 2.5%. graduate certificates, enrollment in those programs went up 2.6%. So there's an opportunity there for us as well to focus our attention on. Next slide, please. And we already do focus our attention in these areas, don't get me wrong. But throughout the planning process, we'll dive into these areas even more to see how we can expand and grow, okay, really capitalize on the demand that's there and what students are really looking for right now. A recent Lumina Foundation study found that amongst U.S. adults without a college degree that are not enrolled in any certificate or college program, 44% have considered enrolling in a bachelor's program, an associate program, or some sort of certificate program, right? 85% of those that attended pre-pandemic that stopped out because of the pandemic, they're considering re-enrolling in college. And 51% of Black and multiracial students without a college degree have considered coming back for a certificate or a degree in the past 2 years. What does that mean? There is a demand here. Students that stopped out or don't have a degree, they're thinking about coming back to college. And this is a ripe opportunity for us to really look at the return on investment in these segments. Like, how do we invest our money in these areas? How do we create strategies to target these adult learners? Because the percentages here suggest that students are thinking about going back to school. They want to go back to school. So what do we have to do to get them here? And we need to launch a very aggressive recruitment and marketing campaign in these areas to attract these students, get them here, persist, graduate, but also evaluate program offerings that will appeal to these age groups. The study showed that associate degrees and certificate programs are the most popular credentials of interest among unenrolled students. So that's that upskilling, reskilling. Cost is always a barrier, but because we are so affordable, that is also, you know, messaging, marketing messaging that we really need to communicate to the adult learners, to all students really, but to this particular population who might be worried about coming back to school because they can't afford it. So that ties into the financial literacy program that we talked about earlier. And all of this will be incorporated into the strategic enrollment plan. Next slide, please. So are there any questions right now about those sectors? About the sectors, opportunities for UDC, what that means? Okay. If you think of any, you know, please at the end, feel free to ask. We're going to jump into strategic enrollment planning. What that means, this is very high level. Strategic enrollment planning, it's critical. It's a continuous and data-informed process, much like the strategic institutional strategic plan, where it's always about constant improvement, doing introspection, look at what we're doing, what are we doing well, what are we doing not so good. It's very similar, and that the strategic enrollment plan comes directly from the institutional strategic plan. So we're finishing up equity imperative. We started planning for the new strategic plan. So this is a perfect time right now to start having discussions and creating working groups and our plan of action to create a strategic enrollment plan. So this is perfect timing. But the strategic enrollment plan comes directly from the strategic plan. During the strategic enrollment planning process, we're going to look at enrollment key performance indicators. We're going to look at strategies and action items and what do we do. And then we're going to set some real goals. And there's steps to this, and we'll get to this in the next two slides. But that's what's happening during the strategic enrollment planning process. Every year, though, so you'll have a strategic enrollment plan that might be 3 or 5 years, whatever we determine it to be, where we set our goals and we work towards those goals over the next 3 to 5 years. But annually, we will look at, you know, how we're our progress, you know, that we've been working on over the past year, monitor the work that we've been doing, what action items have we successfully completed, which ones are challenging us, and we'll make modifications and amendments to the plan as necessary. So it's an ongoing cyclical process of self-review. Next slide, please. Thank you. So in order for a strategic enrollment plan to be successful, there has to be buy-in, and it starts from the top down, right? There has to be buy-in. Everybody has to have vested ownership in this process in order for it to work. It has to be collaborative and participatory, and we'll talk about what that looks like in a minute. but also the understanding that enrollment growth and retention are everyone's responsibility. You know, not just that new VP of Enrollment Services or not SDS. It's everyone's responsibility. And my vision for this process is to incorporate campus-wide, people across campus into this process so that we have vested ownership. Everybody knows it's their responsibility. Everybody has a hand in seeing it be successful. So starts at the top with the cabinet, the CFO, making sure they agree on the process and the plan and the planning context. A successful SEP has to be grounded in data, right? Not anecdotes. We know that. You know from the accreditation process, Middle States wants to see data-driven decisions. They want to see evidence. So the same with this process. We really need to dig into our internal data, our current data, and external data. And there must be broad participation. So leadership from cabinet, leadership from the steering committee. There'll be a steering committee that will drive this process. There has to be a solid communication plan where we hold town halls and we give our people an opportunity to have input in the process and a say in what the goals and priorities are, to have a voice in this process, but also having the right people from each division at the table, okay? So it's going to be very important that this process comes from a place of institution first and that there's a commitment to the process. Like everybody has to be willing to roll up their sleeves and do the work. There must be faculty representation. That's critically important to this process. It's not just an administrative thing. Faculty has to be involved. We need to hear the voice. Students will be involved. Ms. Bird and her team, our institutional research team, critical to this process as we have to understand where we've been, you know, our historical data to understand what's currently happening, our situational analysis, and then where we're going. So that data is going to be important. But we're going to have many people from the academic side, the administrative side, all of us working in these committees and working groups to get this done. This process can take anywhere from 9 to 18 months. It is my goal to have it done as soon as we possibly can because we have such an amazing team, right? And so many people that are change ready. Let me say that again. You have to be change ready in order for this process to be successful. We can't continue to do things the way that they were and expect something different. So this process is going to require that the team and the university be change ready to do things different in order to grow our numbers and go in the direction that we want to go. Throughout this planning process, something that I call the comprehensive six P's, right? Six P's in order to get this done. We have to consider program, place, price, promotion, purpose, and process. So what do I mean by program? We're going to look at academic programs, co-curricular programs, services, all the supports that we have in place. We're going to look at what are our high and low yielding academic programs. What are we doing? What can we do differently? All of this will be rolled into the plan. Place. This is on-site. Is it going to be on? Are we looking at on-site offerings? We're looking at off-site, online, hybrid modalities. How are we offering our courses, and what does that mean for enrollment? Price, obvious, tuition, fees, discounts. What kind of incentives are we offering that drive enrollment, that impact enrollment? Promotion, this is a big one. This is our marketing. This is our recruitment. This is our web presence. From what I understand, we're in discussion about revamping our website. So this is a critical piece that we'll have to address in the strategic enrollment plan as well. Purpose is our mission, our brand. Who are we? What are we doing? Who are we? Who are we trying to attract? What makes us distinct? What separates us apart from everybody else? And to be able to communicate that to the students that we are looking to attract. And again, our process, data-informed processes, how are we currently doing business? How can we be more efficient? How does it affect enrollment? Next slide, please. This is very high level, these planning phases. As we get into the work, you will see in detail how we flush these four phases out. But phase one of the planning process, which we will kick off soon within the next, get this up and going, you know, May, June, is preparation and data analysis. This is where you're looking at understanding our current environment. Here's the situation analysis. What is going on? What are the key performance indicators? How will we know if we're successful? You know, where are we trying to go given what's going on? How do we know if we're going? How do we know? How do we measure, right? So having discussions around that. The second phase, and people always ask, well, you know, Dr. Titus, well, why don't you just set goals up front? Well, that comes later once you understand what's going on. You know, you have to understand what your current situation is before you can set lofty goals. So that's why I always start out with data collection and situation analysis. Second is strategy. What can we do different? Building an action plan. Who's doing what? When? Looking at that return on investment conversation. If we invest in this area, how will this affect enrollment in those key markets and demographics that I talked about earlier, or other markets or demographics that are identified through phase one, those discussions. Phase three is your goals, right? Let's make some projections, let's set our goals, and then we finalize this written SEP plan. And then stage four, finally, is implementation and continuation. Cyclical process again. We implement the plan. We work on our action items. It's nonstop. So we're in these working groups. We're holding each other accountable. They're still reporting back to the steering committee on their progress. We report to you and the university community about all the work that we've done, what we were able to accomplish. We assess and we update as necessary. So it's an ongoing process. Next slide. So that is my vision. That is the direction I'm looking to go in terms of strategic enrollment planning over the next few months. And I graciously ask for all of your support as we jump into the work. It is important, like I said, that buy-in comes from leadership, the board, that it's communicated that this is something that's a priority. And I'm excited about getting it done. Any questions?
Thank you very much for this exciting presentation. Who would like to jump in here? Mignon, Trustee Clyburn.
All right. Thank you for the presentation. And I would like to jump in with an offer. You know, if you see that there are any places or ways that we could be leveraged, meaning as a board, to amplify a lot of the, you know, points that you've touched, you know, I see that as a positive for, you know, having excitement coming from the outside in and you know, continually, you know, to resonate in a perpetual circular manner. You know, all of this, you know, from where I sit, you know, could be very, you know, a positive about attracting more donors and partners and the like. So you talk about the different, and it's been mentioned more than once, you know, how are we different? And we have not, it's not just about showing different, you know, showing how we're different and doing things differently, but, you know, having that being a part of the refrain in order for it to resonate. So, not necessarily, you know, a co-signing, but an offer, almost a mandate to you, you know, to ensure, you know, lean on us and to ask specifics in these target areas where, you know, you know, check out our backgrounds and our peers, or where we want to be. So, you know, this could be as much of a positive for us to stretch our wings a bit as board members and to layer in and grow this vision as what you envision on the ground every day. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for that offer. I really appreciate that. And believe me, I will take you up on it.
Trustee Jarvis.
Yes, I appreciate your professionalism and your approach to enrollment management. It's welcome, and it's your focus on a full involvement of the whole school is I think a very important part of that. I have long thought. Well, the first thing I want to ask is that there's been a recent strategic strategic plan, but I guess you'd call it the strategic plan that identified issues or advantages or disadvantages of the university. I wonder how, what do you call that, Dr. Mason? I'm looking for the name. President Mason.
The process that Link is leading?
That Link did, yeah. What? Yeah.
So it's developing the next iteration of a strategic plan, but it's gotten as far as the goals and sub-goals.
Yeah.
Which is still being vetted with the faculty and students.
Yeah, so I guess my question is, to what extent the strategic enrollment plan is working with or benefiting from the outcomes in the strategic plan, this new strategic plan that was done? Dr. Tyers?
Well, I know the second iteration is underway, but we can definitely build off the first, because not all of the initiatives from the first strategic plan were completed. There's still work that's going to carry over into the second iteration. So, you know, we have an idea. We have an idea of already what the second plan, the second iteration is going to, you know, carry forward. So we can definitely begin from there. But the whole strategic plan doesn't have to be fleshed out for us to do our work. As long as we know what the priorities are, the main priorities are of the strategic plan, kind of what the direction, some of the main priorities, we could go from there. And then as we communicate, as we set goals in the strategic planning process, as long as we communicate that to, you know, the board, make sure we're all in alignment as the second iteration gets fleshed out, we could still continue to do the work and move the planning process forward.
Yeah, I guess one of the most important things that came out of that strategic planning process is that it is not clear to people who we are. That was part of the sort of a major outcome. And so I asked that question because, you know, that's an answer you're going to have also as you begin to think about the strategic enrollment plan. And I have often thought that there is a pool of students that we could tap into. And that is, these are students who may have finished a degree. They may live in the neighborhood of this university. They may have time during the day to be in classes, and we're under-enrolled during the day, I think it's fair to say. And so the question is, how do you tap into that pool of people who would come in and take a cybersecurity class who had a major in art history or something? And how can we better use the facilities of the university during the day, when most of our students are, in fact, in school still at night? And I guess that is still the data point, isn't it? That the university still is mainly a school of students at night. Dr. Latham, is that so?
It's true, Trustee Jarvis. It is true.
Okay, so we have an opportunity to really dip into the pool of people who would come here in the daytime for perhaps continuing ed courses. And I hope that that's something that you would, you know, begin to think about.
Thank you. I wrote down that question, and I'll make sure that it's a question that gets asked during the first phase, that situational awareness phase, where we ask that question and really take a look at it.
Yeah, but you have a very professional approach to this, and it's welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. So good to see you again.
Nice to see you, too.
Are there other questions, comments, observations?
Go forth.
I think if I could offer a couple of reflections. This was one of the densest sets of materials I have seen for this committee, and I, for one, spent a long time with them and felt that there was a lot more time that could be spent and a lot more discussion that there could be around it. I would hope at some point the committee could spend some time discussing what it would hope to understand more about the outcomes for the committee. We have a lot that's going on now in terms of new staff planning. We have middle states coming up where they're asking about outcomes for the institution. So this may well not quite be the time, but I hope as the Middle States draft goes forward, it will provide fodder for us to think and talk about what we most want to understand in terms of what we think are the best performance standards for the institutions, for the institution, in terms of what we find the best outcomes, the best measurables, the greatest yardsticks by which we want to evaluate our institutional performance. And so I hope at some point we'll set aside time to think about that, because there are a lot of provocative numbers, a lot of provocative concepts that are hard, I find, to wrap your head around. And when I was the president and had a vice president who was running our student outcomes and had volumes upon volumes upon volumes of data sitting behind her desk, I would find myself having conversations with her, and in a not flip way, I would ask her the question, so what? I wanted to know, so what? What could I say about all this collected data, and what policies would it lead us to make? What kinds of evaluations, what kind of policies would it lead us to make? And it was of burning importance to me to understand that. So I think as trustees and as people trying to understand the institution, the so what question is really important. At least I find it is to me. So if it is to the rest of you, I hope at some time we can have a so what discussion. We know the so what of enrollment. But what are the other so whats that matter a lot to us? Student mental health is obviously a so what. We talked a lot about that today. Some of the passage rates, but do we have a good handle on the simplest expression of what the passage rates ought to be in terms of percentages? What are our clear statements of goals? If it matters to you too, let's talk about it sometime, about having a stronger handle on what some of these goals ought to be, what the so whats ought to be. I at least would like to. I keep trying to develop them for myself. If they matter to you too, let's talk about it sometime. So thanks very much. If there is no further business, I think we should entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Thank you very much. A second. All in favor, let's just say aye. And
aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much for good.